Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Michael Schwartz. Michael Schwartz is an emeritus distinguished teaching professor of sociology at Stony Brook State University, and he is the author of 6 books and another one forthcoming, and scores of articles and commentaries, including award-winning books on popular protest and insurgency. His most recent book, War Without End, analyzes how the militarized geopolitics of oil led the U.S. to dismantle the Iraqi state and economy while fueling sectarian civil war inside Iraq. His work on the Middle East appears regularly in Tom Dispatch at tomdispatch.com, and that includes his latest article, which is called The Great Game in the Holy Land. Michael Schwartz, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you on. I was incredibly impressed and intrigued by this article, The Great Game in the Holy Land, because of the story it tells about Israel's interest in natural gas and what it's led to. And you start with a discovery in the early 1990s. Can you tell us what developed then?
Back in the early 1990s, people were not as concerned with natural gas as they are these days, or countries weren't, or corporations weren't, but there was a lot of rumor that there was natural gas offshore, off the Gaza coast. And when the Oslo accords were negotiated, one of the elements in that was Israel recognizing that any offshore natural gas or other resources would belong to the Palestinians. So then, if you fast forward 6, 7, 8 years, the Palestinians bring in British Gas, which is one of the global gas companies, natural gas companies, sort of the British equivalent of BP, to see whether there really was some of this stuff there. And sure enough, they found a fairly substantial, by world standards, a rather small, but nevertheless, from the point of view of the Palestinians, an incredible amount of natural gas that would not only supply them, but make them a supplier and give them a revenue stream that would be, you know, far in excess of any revenue streams they could possibly get from the situation they were in. So they negotiated a deal with British Gas that would ultimately give British Gas about 90% of the revenues. And they'd get 10%, which would be in the billion-dollar range, and were ready to start developing that.
To clarify on the Oslo Accords, under the Oslo Accords, Israel did not claim this. It allowed the Palestinian Authority to claim this natural gas, right?
Right, and this whole negotiation took place under the watchful eye of the Israelis, and they never complained about it. But when it was finally settled, it was right at the time when Israel began to face an authentic and increasingly difficult hydrocarbon crisis. And so they kind of intervened in the negotiations to start with. In the year 2000, and they said, we're sorry, this deal that you've got, in which the gas is going to be extracted by British Gas, they're going to ship it over to Egypt and then ship it on to the rest of the world, that's not going to be acceptable to us because we want that gas. That's essentially what Israel said.
And you note, Michael, that Israel did not even consider investing in renewable energies. Why was that?
I can't answer that question altogether, but at that moment in the year 2000, Israel was in a really pretty good place to be a kind of pioneer. Their crisis was not deep enough that they had to say, well, we have some emergency needs. They could be buying their natural gas on the spot market. You know, they have very lousy relationships with most of the suppliers of gas and oil. So they are limited, but there was plenty. The price was not too high, et cetera, et cetera. And there were authentic proposals to develop various renewable resources in Israel and in partnership with other countries. But they didn't pursue that. There was a choice made that they were going to go for hydrocarbons, fossil fuels, and they began looking at the various options. An interesting side story to that is that they discovered that there's a lot of shale oil in Israel, in the Israeli, you know, main area, not the occupied areas, and they might have been able to develop that. And several years later, there was a real consideration of that as this crisis got more deeper, and the environmentalists were able to fend it off based on the idea that they were going to destroy the very precious water resources that Israel, you know, has always had a problem with. And in fact, Israel has been taking the water from Jordan, from the Palestinians, and from the Lebanese, creating another round of conflicts there. And they said, well, you're going to ruin the oil, you're going to ruin the water, the groundwater, so you can't do that. And when the environmentalists were very strong at that moment, this is 5 years later, you'd think they would have then said, well, let's go for wind power, for water power, et cetera, et cetera. And they didn't do it then either, and they instead amplified their efforts to get at the new sources of natural gas that were arising. The main one, or the first one, I wouldn't call it even the main one at this point, was the Gaza gas. So there's this period, you know, that goes for years, really, in which Israel is pressing to get at the Gaza natural gas. And they keep asking for it with what at first were a set of escalating demands, because first they said, okay, we don't like this deal because we're not going to get the gas. We want the gas, and we want it at a discounted price. So then Tony Blair intervened on behalf of British Gas and said, let's see if I can negotiate this deal. And he began a negotiation that he led for the next 10 years around this gas, and said, okay, well, we'll instead of taking it out of the Mediterranean and shipping it to Egypt, we'll ship it to Israel. And Israel will be the recipient of the gas, and they will get sort of first dibs on it. They will get a discounted price for being the transit point for this gas. That looked like that deal was going to be signed. Now, the Palestinian Authority didn't like that idea at all because Israel uses control over their resources in all sorts of ways. But they finally gave in to the idea. But the Israelis said, no, we don't like this idea either because we don't want British Gas to give any money to the Palestinians. And that's when they first raised, and this is before Hamas was a factor, right? That's an important part of it. This is before Hamas was a factor. They said, well, we can't allow any revenues from this to go to the Palestinians because they'll use it to build rockets and attack us. So Israel was effectively claiming control over all the revenues as well as all the gas.
As if Israel wouldn't build any weapons whatsoever.
Yeah, right. But this is part of this long-term Israeli policy of needing to control the Palestinians so that whatever was going on in Palestinian areas was accessible to Israel. You know, and that's the gas in this case, but over on the West Bank, it's the land that they keep continuing to acquire and so on and so forth, right? The real estate.
Sure.
And the water and so on. And they don't want to give the Palestinians any leverage that would allow them to really demand a degree of sovereignty. And I say in the article, and I think it's really important, is that the moment when the Israelis make this demand that they're going to have to control all the revenues, it's the same as the Israelis declaring that the Oslo Accords are done, because that means that what they're saying is there's never a time when we're going to allow the Palestinians to have any degree of sovereignty. I mean, this wasn't even sovereignty that they were asking for. It was just to have a degree of financial autonomy where they would have their own budget.
Well, so this ended the Oslo Accords?
Yeah, this pretty much. I think the Oslo Accords were dead before then, but they weren't officially declared as dead. This was the official declaration, I think.
So the Federal Reserve is introduced then?
Blair comes up with this compromise, right? He says, if you're worried that these revenues are going to be used for terrorism, what we'll do is we'll ship all the proceeds that the Palestinians are supposed to get to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and they will oversee all expenditures by the Palestinian Authority.
Who would still only be getting 10% of their their money, right?
Yeah, they'd be getting 10%, but it's still, from the Palestinian point of view, it's $1 billion. It's a huge amount of discretionary spending that they might really be able to do something with, right?
Yeah.
But Israel said they didn't trust the Federal Reserve, and they felt that the Palestinians were going to be much cleverer at figuring out how to use it for terror, and that only Israel, and in fact, they escalated their demands at that point, and Israel said, we won't ever allow any money to go to the Palestinians. What we will do is they can make requests for us, and we will decide what to buy with the money and ship to them, which is what they are doing now, right? Essentially, the Israelis control every dime that the Palestinian Authority is going to spend, and they don't spend it. They spend it for them, and they deliver whatever products they think should have. What you have is, that was the declaration in about 2005, right? And that compromise, so they were unwilling to do the Federal Reserve, and that is just at the time when Hamas started to win elections. Israel decided was that as far as this gas was concerned, they would just extract the gas on their own and just take it. Now, they have a record of doing that already. In fact, they had already, at that moment in time, had the Israeli Supreme Court declare that any resources on any occupied land that they occupied belonged to Israel and could be exploited. The trouble was that, on that account, you know, the British gas would be out, the Israelis would find new contractors, probably American contractors, they typically do, and just start extracting the gas. But the trouble was, is that the gas is just offshore in Gaza, and even those meager rockets that that Hamas has are capable of knocking it out. So they make the decision at that point that A, they have to get the gas, and B, that they're going to have to really pretty much cripple Gaza, make it unable to do any kind of fighting in order to secure these gas facilities. And there's quotes from the current foreign minister of Israel, he was previously the head of the IDF, and then he was, you know, a politician of various stripes for a while, and now he's the foreign minister again, Yalon, who actually just wrote it down and said, this is what we have to do. We have to completely annihilate the willingness of the Palestinians in Gaza to resist in order to get at this oil, and that's going to mean stopping them from having any military capacity at all. And 2 years, so they started with I keep calling it a boycott, but it's the blockade of Gaza, which is now so infamous, right? We're going to put them on a diet is the kind of key quote, right? But the diet is something that, you know, creates chronic malnutrition. And that's when they really shut all the borders there, and they said nothing's coming in and out of Gaza that we don't control, and we're going to decide that you're really pretty much getting nothing and that you're going to be in a state of continuous immiseration. And very explicitly, leaders from the Israeli government said, we're doing this in order to get them to oust Hamas and to say uncle and to agree to this oil deal that we want, which is that we get all the oil, we get all the revenues, and we dole out to the Gazans as much as we think they deserve.
We are speaking with Michael Schwartz about his article, The Great Game in the Holy Land. So, Michael, are you... typically we're told from the Israeli point of view that the blockade and the attacks on Gaza are motivated by defense against the threatening enemy. Are you suggesting that the blockade was initiated in order to prevent the Gazans resisting the theft of gas just off their shores?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting, you know, they have many... many motives, the Israeli government. I mean, let's not have a government have motives. The leadership of the Israeli government have many motives in the ways that they have assaulted Gaza. But there is this underlying and continuing drive for these resources that really is the engine of a lot of what's going on. And many of the other reasons they have for doing the various things they do shoot off from that more general aim, which is to get and control the resources and the land that the Palestinians inhabit, both in Gaza and the West Bank. And the institution of the blockade was clearly an effort. They said it over and over again that it was an effort to convince the Gazans to abandoned the militant stance that Hamas was holding, right? And that militant stance, Hamas was very, very explicit, for example, around the question of this Gazan gas, that they weren't going to accept a deal in which Israel got all the resources and then doled out to the Palestinians whatever they thought they deserved. and Hamas had made that declaration. It was right after that that Israel instituted the blockade, and that various policymakers said this blockade is aimed at getting them to accept the oil deal. You know, that's what they were looking at that time. You know, obviously they had other reasons as well, but this was really a central piece of it. And when it failed, as it failed, then what happened was is they moved to more explicit military attacks. And so Operation Cast Lead was very much a continuation of that policy. And
that's 2008, bombing of Gaza.
Yeah, 2008, we're going, you know, we're moving forward. All this stuff, you know, is always mediated by various kinds of negotiations and threats back and forth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Things move slowly, and then boom, you know, you get Operation Cast Lead, and they, you know, they have some precipitating incident that, but they were planning it a year before. For a whole year, they were planning Operation Cast Lead, and you, if you look at the details of what kind of an operation they did. In Cast Lead, and then the latest one, the name of Protective Edge is the latest one, which is even more vicious than Cast Lead, right?
Yeah.
They are always very focused on the rockets. And the reason that these rockets are so important, if you look at the actual threats that the rockets create, it's pretty minimal. I mean, the rockets in the last battle killed three people, a total of three people. There were 57, I think 58 Israeli casualties. All the others were soldiers who were in Gaza, and they weren't killed by rockets. There were three people killed by rockets, and that's after thousands and thousands of rockets, right? So why are they worried about rockets if they know they can defend themselves against it? You know, they have this vaunted Iron Dome, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it is wonderful propaganda. We aren't just vicious killers. We are defending ourselves against the rockets, even though it's not true.
Right.
It's good.
So the rockets are really, you know, they have a very good shelter system in the south of Israel, and they have this Iron Dome system, which has about a 90% kill rate for the rockets that they actually aim the Iron Dome at. But what's interesting about the Iron Dome is that it wasn't developed to protect civilians. It was actually developed, originally it was motivated to protect oil facilities in the north of Israel in disputed areas with Lebanon, and Hezbollah has much more sophisticated rockets, and they were worried that the rockets would take out the oil facility. And the Iron Dome system has proven itself to be inadequate to protecting oil facilities for a very simple reason. A 90% kill rate is just not enough when you have some sitting duck oil facility out in the middle of an open sea, right? And all you got to do is shoot 100 of those rockets out there, and 10 of them are going to land. And even if they're terrible Hamas rockets, 8 of the 10 will miss, 2 will hit, and these fragile things will be annihilated. So the Iron Dome system doesn't work, but they developed it in order to protect oil facilities very explicitly. And so they can't go ahead and extract that oil as long as there's a fighting capacity in Gaza. And so what they've done over the years is they've attempted to very systematically eliminate that fighting capacity. And it's interesting in the most recent offensive, you know, they've made a lot of talk about these tunnels that were being designed to create an invasion of Israel, and they were going to annihilate these tunnels. And it's interesting that the tunnels that they went in and annihilated were in the interior of Gaza. And what those tunnels were really functional for, what they actually accomplished was this is the place where the rockets were being stored and assembled. And they are still there, by the way, and that whole offensive did not succeed in preventing Hamas from building rockets. And that offensive was very much designed to annihilate all of this internal area and, you know, all this stuff where they were killing all the civilians. It's because there were tunnels there, right? I mean, and those tunnels were, of course, supposed to be also protection against Israeli air attacks. So it's interesting that, you know, the Israelis can actually argue that, hey, this is a military facility, right? You know, but that's what they were after, and that's why they had to invade, because they had to go in and annihilate the tunnels. But they just weren't really successful in preventing Hamas from rebuilding that.
And annihilate the will to resist, you mentioned earlier. How's the will to resist faring under the attacks? It seems to only increase.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that historically these kinds of attacks have sometimes really worked, you know, to defuse the will to resist among the target people. But it has only worked. I'm talking, you know, the Nazis did it all over to hell and gone, right, you know.
I don't. Where did they eliminate the will to resist?
I'm saying they attempted to do so.
Right? Oh, they attempted, yeah. The governments attempt it all the time, or at least they say that's what they're doing.
Oh, and the U.S. attempted to do the same thing in Iraq.
Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and Pakistan and Somalia and Yemen and so forth. Yeah, it just doesn't seem to work.
But let's also, you know, take into account that the U.S. attempted to do that with Japan and Germany, and many, many people argue that it was successful against Japan, the firebombing of Tokyo, and of course the atom bombs, but that was probably after they had already lost their will to resist, but the firebombing of Tokyo and several other cities, you know, just wholesale annihilation, might really have undermined their will to resist. The interesting part of these historical moments is that it's not so much that you can't, we might even mention shock and awe at the start of the U.S. war in Iraq, or the shock and awe that was used, a sort of moderate case of it, in the original Gulf War, was another attempt to do exactly what the Israelis are trying to do. Most of the time, the initial reaction to this kind of an onslaught is passivity. It is passivity. People generally are pretty much terrified by terror attacks, especially the kind of state terror attacks that the U.S. and Israel and other big powers engage in. The question is what happens after that attack. If what happens after that attack is that people are allowed to go about their way and, you know, reconstruct their lives and so on and so forth, they might be pretty passive. But if what follows is further immiseration, the incapacity of people to conduct their lives, to rebuild their lives, if people aren't given a chance to do something reasonable, then what choice do they have? If you look at history, what happens is that people, after these kinds of attacks, two kinds of things happen pretty regularly. One is people leave. They go somewhere else where they can live a better life. And if they have that option, it often that's the end of it all. And the other is they have to fight. What else choice do they have? If what you're going to do by doing nothing is just continue to get worse and worse and worse and worse, and you're going to be looking at death, then people find ways to fight back. And that's what's going on with Israel and Palestine, because it's not. It's really not so much the attacks that create the fight back. It's what's after the attacks that creates the fight back, which is further immiseration. We're looking at it right now. Somebody came up with a figure of, I've forgotten how many tens of billions of dollars needed to rebuild Gaza back to a level in which people actually could not starve to death. And then they found out that how much resources the Israelis are allowing in there. And they said, well, it will take 100 years to rebuild at this rate. So what's going on in Gaza? The people there have nothing, and they have continued immiseration. And, of course, what they're going to do is they're going to try to find a way to reverse that. And so there is one kind of fight or another. You know, it's not always inevitable what the kind of struggle will be.
Of course, it can be violent or nonviolent or take many forms. But before we run out of time, I want to, because your article is wonderful, and I recommend people go and read it, The Great Game in the Holy Land, because you go on to describe further discoveries of gas further north in the Mediterranean and struggle brewing among a handful of countries around that, and greater desperation growing in Israel for gas and oil, and you make the claim that all of the wars in the Middle East are in large part at least about oil and gas. What is going to come, and what can be done?
Well, what can be done is a really terribly fraught question. I mean, I think, you know, We need those of us who are worried about these kinds of things and this kind of, you know, wholesale destruction, we have to find a way to start influencing not just Israel, what was bad enough, but the U.S. and the European Union, and then Russia and even Turkey. You know, I mean, in the Eastern Mediterranean, you now have about 30 or 40 times as much gas as there was originally discovered in Gaza. The contenders for it are Lebanon, Syria, Israel, Cyprus. They are all contenders to exploit this natural gas. That's what they call it, the Levantine Basin gas now. And so Israel has marked itself out as claiming all of it right away. This is in 2010, and said, we're going to take it all. And so all the other guys started saying, well, how are we going to protect ourselves from that? So there was almost a war between Lebanon and Israel right at the beginning of that moment. And then, of course, there's Syria, which is having, you know, a huge civil war. So Syria says, well, the only way we're going to be able to get a hold of this, Assad says, I've got to sign on with Russia. So Russia now has rights to develop the Syrian part of that gas, which of course is also claimed by Israel, and it's also claimed by Cyprus. And Cyprus has its own little civil war going on, and they brought Turkey in. The Turkish part of Cyprus brought Turkey in. Now Turkey has their warships patrolling all around Cyprus, and they're developing that gas there, and they're saying to the Israelis, you try to come over here and we're going to fight you. And they're saying to the Russians, you know, this is our domain, and you stay down there in Syria. Russians have signed on with Lebanon. So now Lebanon, Israel has already developed a couple of controversial areas that Lebanon also claims, and there could be a fight over that, or there could be a fight over further fields that the Russians are going to directly develop once they can get going on them.
I'm afraid, Michael, that we don't have time left to list all the areas of potential crisis, but it is an incredibly valuable contribution that you're making, reminding us that these wars are not all about ancient ethnic hatreds and so forth. They are in great part about oil. We've been speaking with Michael Schwartz, Emeritus Distinguished Teaching Professor at Stony Brook State University, and author of books and articles you need to read, and I will have the links up at TalkNationRadio.org. Michael Schwartz, thank you for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at RootsAction.org. Help end war at WorldBeyondWar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.